The fact that we're talking about marriage tonight and the family has encouraged me to talk about an issue that Julie and I have that we're concerned about. You are all marriage counselors, are involved in marriage, and this could be a serious issue. And I thought maybe I could bring it up before you, and we could you could talk to us and maybe help us in some way before we leave Queensland. We have run into the problem of the air in Queensland, in Australia in general, but I guess especially here in Queensland. There's something wrong with the air. It seems to be shrinking our clothes. That must be what it is, because they're getting tighter and tighter. I don't know whether the pavlova has anything to do with it or these other things that we're experiencing, but I can tell you, next week we start on a diet, the day after Easter. But we have appreciated everything, really, that we've experienced since we've been here. The day before we left, I got a little notice in the mail from an old friend of mine, and he said, "Well, I formed a new organization, Gary. I thought I'd tell you about it." It's an organization called the National Center for Fathering, of all things. And he said, "I was very much concerned about building the family and how we as Christians could build the family. Where is there a place for building the family? Where is the major emphasis on building the family?" And he said, "We decided that we could strengthen fathers and the relationships that fathers have with their children." So the goals of the National Center on Fathering, I thought, were very interesting. Number one, to be a clear voice championing the role of fathering. Number two, to equip professionals, laymen, and groups working with fathers to more successfully help these men to actively lead in their homes and in their children's lives. Number three, to be a leading study center, library, and credible source of fathering data. And number four, to research the unique challenges faced by fathers who are culturally different: Black, in the military, in prison, executives, clergy, and those who have the special role of stepfather, grandfather, or non-custodial father. I talked very briefly to these people. This man who formed this organization is a very good friend of mine. And I was impressed with what he was doing, focusing on the importance of the father because of the role that the father plays in the family and the role that the father plays in the home, and how the father has so often seems to have abdicated that role. It came to my special attention after I looked at that. I was reading in this little book that I mentioned this morning, John Smith's book, Advance Australia Where. It's kind of an old book. It was published in 1988, and I guess for psychology and counseling books, this isn't really one of those, but it's a book that seems to be a little bit old. But I thought it was interesting what one of your fellow countrymen said about fathering in this country. He begins by quoting an anonymous Englishman. I can understand why he's anonymous when you read the quote. "He is a very well-balanced man, the Australian. He has a chip on both shoulders." Well, that was kind of interesting. Then he makes a statement from Ronald Conway, whom I mentioned earlier. He calls him author, psychologist, and Christian. And this was the first time that I had picked up that Ronald Conway was a Christian. As you may remember, in Melbourne. Historically, he says, "The absence of strong, affectionate, fatherly guidance precedes all the other syndromes in Australia. It is into a vacuum of domestic influence left by a derelict and domestically shirking father that the Australian wife has been promoted to move, often to her own emotional frustration and transfer of that same frustration to her over-mother children and to her sons in particular." In other words, the fathers have not fulfilled their roles in Australia, just like they have not fulfilled their roles at home. And the mothers have had to take over, and it's been very frustrating for some of those mothers. "The father problem," says Ronald Conway, "has intensified over the last couple of generations because of the vicious cycle created by a home climate where father rooms as a bachelor-type breadwinner on the outer perimeter of the household. His sons are persuaded to believe in turn that this is all the father and the husband can be expected to do." John Smith adds this: "I believe Conway has accurately pictured the Australian domestic scene as matriarchal with respect to the establishment of values and relationships. Conway's thesis is that the most influential institution within the Western society is the home. On a school parent-teacher night, it is usually the mom who goes. And if dad attends, he's like you to spend one foot, he's like you to stand on one foot looking and feeling awkward. If there is a complaint against the teacher, it's usually the mom who makes it. There are very few homes where the husband is leader and provider at the emotional and spiritual level of the family. This is in a chapter called The Aussie Male, as Smith talks about the culture of Australia and how this relates to the church. A few pages later, he talks about a survey that was conducted in Australia, I guess 3 or 4 years ago now, in which they asked a number of women what they most wanted from men. And they asked men what they thought women most wanted. Very interesting. What did the women most want? Caring, a man who is caring and understanding of my needs. 72% of the women checked that. This was a poll conducted by both Women's Weekly and The Bulletin. 72% of the women said, I want a man who is caring and understanding of my needs. When they asked the men, they said, how many women are concerned about that? 72% of the women were concerned about it. 10% of the men thought that women were concerned about this. It's interesting what the men thought women were most concerned about. 46% of the men said they want somebody who is handsome and physically attracted. You know how many women wanted men who are handsome and physically attractive? You said 10, you're close. 14%. And I think it's interesting these differences. I'll give you a couple more. 66% of the women want a stable and reliable husband, somebody I can depend on. Only 12% of the men thought that was important to the women. This is interesting. 42% of the women wanted a man who values a woman's friendship more than sex. Only 4% of the men thought that was important. 40% of the men said, 40% women want somebody who is macho. 2% of the women wanted somebody who was macho. Isn't that interesting? 48% of the women said, I want somebody who is intelligent. Only 19% of the men thought that was important. 48% of the women said, I want somebody who is sensitive. Only 5% of the men thought that was important. Or how about this one? 47% of the women said, I want somebody who's not afraid to show feelings, somebody who can cry. Guess how many men thought that was important? None? What did you say? 2%. You're right on. Now, isn't this interesting? The differences of perceptions that we have about what women want in a marriage and what men want in a marriage. When I was in Australia the last time, I clipped something out of the Age newspaper. It was a report that was reporting a summary that had been done among Australians on a different topic on your most important goal in life. And they asked a group of Australians, I can't spot here how, yes, 1,000 voters in Australia were from all parts of the country, were surveyed by telephone, and they were asked this question. I'd like you to tell me what you regard as the most important thing in life. Could you tell me which of the following is most important to you in your as your goal in life? And they gave them 5 choices. Which are more important? Number 1, a prosperous life, that is, having a good income and being able to afford the good things in life. Number 2, an important life, that is, having a life of achievement and recognition. Number 3, a secure life, making sure that basic needs and necessities are provided for. Number 4, an exciting life, one that is stimulating and active. And number 5, a family life. Which of those 5 is most important for you? Well, it's interesting that when you put all the people together, they've broken this down in terms of the different voters in different parts of the country and that kind of thing. But when you put everybody together, 42% of the respondents said the most important thing for me is a family life. 33% said a secure life. And all of the other, a prosperous life, an important life, and an exciting life, were down with less than 10% of the respondents. These people, in a national poll, wanted a family life. It's interesting to me that when they broke this down into two groups of people. Those who found religion to be of great importance, and those who found religion to be of no importance. The people who said religion was of great importance, 56% said, we want a family life. That's most important to us. 29% of those who had no interest in religion said they wanted a family life. Now, of those who had no interest in religion, 40% said, a secure life is what we want. But of the believers, of the people who were religious, only 25% said a secure life was important. See, among believers, over half the people wanted a secure family life. Among the non-believers, 40% were concerned about a secure life, and 15% wanted a prosperous life. It's interesting to me that there seems to be a difference between those who are religious and those who are not. Those of us who are believers, I suggest, are people who know that we have a security in Christ. Yes, we're concerned about that. But there seems to be a great concern about the family, about building stronger families, about strengthening marriages. And yet marriages and families, as we all know, have some difficulties and have problems. Now certainly, this is something that a topic that I approach with a great deal of care and somewhat insecurity. Because I recognize again that I come as an outsider. And we come from different cultures, but we do know this. We do know that in our different cultures, we have a number of family problems. Before coming to Australia, I discovered that you have one of the lowest murder rates in any society. We have a very high murder rate, and many of those murders occur in the home, incidentally. You have, however, one of the highest suicide rates in the world, especially among teenagers. When I was in New Zealand last year, a report came out in which it said that New Zealand had the highest suicide rate among teenagers in the world. And Australia is not very far behind. Why are these kids having so many struggles and so many insecurities and difficulties? You have a large population, a growing population, of homeless people, many of whom are young children who are in families that are homeless. And we have this problem too. I'm not pointing the finger. But I think it's interesting to see that there are people who don't even have the security of a home in Australia. You have the highest per capita rate of alcohol consumption in the world. And you have a number of family problems, one of the highest gambling rates in the world. You also have, I've discovered, the highest home ownership rate of any nation in the Western world. And how's this for a useful fact, or maybe a not a very practical fact? Australians, despite the cost, Australians buy more books per person than almost any other nation in the world. It doesn't say that Australians read more books than any other nation, but you buy more books. And I can relate to you beautifully because I have this tendency to have a great love for bookstores. Like a dog cannot pass a fire hydrant, I cannot pass a bookstore. And I have discovered that I buy books whether I need them or not. I came on this trip, I brought four books with me that I thought, okay, that will cover my reading. I keep picking up books as I go along. Somebody said, don't buy books in Australia. They're expensive here. Yes, but I'm buying books about Australia and Australian books and all kinds of fun things that I'm encountering. Now I'm going to need another month to read them all. But we see that there's a lot of interest in that in this country. And yet, I also see that in this country, there is a great concern about migration. You know this in Queensland. There was an article in the paper just 10 days ago about the new immigrants in Australia, ourselves. We are moving from one part of the country to another. And not too many people are moving from this part of the country to other states, but people are moving from other states here. I discovered that as we drove around yesterday and looked at some of the construction and the growth coming in this beautiful city in which you live and in this whole part of the eastern coast of Australia. And people have to adjust to moving. Sometimes I think moving can be one of the most stressful experiences in the world and can put a lot of emphasis on, a lot of pressure on a family, especially when the moves come frequently. You are also a population, I've discovered, that is getting older. Of course, we're all getting older, but I mean in terms of the percentage of the population who are over 65. Like other countries in the world, there is an increasing number of people who are experiencing this kind of growth. You can understand, therefore, why a visitor to your country finds it a fascinating country to see these changes that are taking place and some of the exciting things that are happening here. Now, all of this gets us as background to the question of the families. Question of the role of the father, the role of the mother, the role of the husband and wife, the whole issue of parenting. Now, I know some of you are experts in this. You spend your whole professional careers working on this. You are concerned about building better marriages. What can we say in these few minutes that we have together tonight that will be helpful and will stimulate some thought as we ponder this? Well, I would like to give three major thrusts tonight, if I could. I would like to begin with a biblical perspective on the family. We'll look at one passage of Scripture which you might not think about in terms of the family, and we'll look at it very briefly. Then I would like to look at a research perspective on the family and share with you some results of old research, but I think is still relevant and relevant to this country as we ponder families and family stability. Then I'd like to look a little bit at a counselor perspective on the family. This has come up, quite frankly, out of some of my informal discussions with some of you today, because I've recognized that some of you are involved in counseling and people helping, and it's having an influence and an effect on your own families. And I'd like to focus a little attention on this, and then we'll once again, as has been our custom, end up looking at some questions. So a biblical perspective, a research perspective, and then a counseling perspective on the family. Let's begin, if we can, with the biblical perspective on the family. I suppose if you were asked to give a talk on the family, and you were going to turn to some passage of Scripture that would deal with the family, I would guess that most of you would turn to the same passage of Scripture. The one part of the New Testament that says more about the family than any other part of the New Testament, and that is where? Ephesians chapter 5. And here is the place where we read about the role of the husband, the role of the wife, the role of the fathers, not exasperating their children, the role of children being obedient to their parents, and the role of employers as they relate to employees. But have you ever looked at the context of these significant verses on the family? Very interesting to look at the verses that come before and after these teachings on the family. And I suggest to you that in the beginning of Ephesians chapter 5 and the end of Ephesians chapter 6, that which sandwiches this crucial portion on the family, there are some significant statements there that have relevance to the family. But chapter 5 of Ephesians begins this way. Be imitators of God, therefore, as beloved children. I suppose that summarizes what comes as follows. We are to be like children, with the enthusiasm of children, the learning, the willingness to learn that children have, and we are to be imitators of God. Now, I don't know how you respond to that, but I could almost stop right there and say, you left me. How am I going to imitate God? I've got weaknesses. I know the things I struggle with. How can a guy like me imitate God? Nobody's seen God at any time. I don't even know what God looks like, except Jesus said, the one who has seen me has seen the Father. And we are to be imitators of Jesus Christ. That's a pretty tall order, isn't it? And that ought to be characteristic of those of us who are in families, and this ought to be something that we should be stimulating in the families with whom we work. Now, how are we going to be imitators of Christ, like beloved children? Well, it gives us some guidelines here. Number one, if we are to be an imitator of Christ, we should be people who are characterized by love. It says in verse 2, live a life of love. Just as Christ loved us and gave himself up for us as a fragrant offering and sacrifice to God. We have Christ's example of love. Jesus said, by this shall all men know that you are my disciples if you have love one for another. I wonder if the word love has been abused, especially as we talk about marriage and the family. We seem to think that love always has sexual connotations. And people get married because they're in love, and they don't realize that love is a sacrificial thing, like Jesus showed in his life. Love is a giving thing, like Jesus showed in his life. Love takes effort, especially after you've been married for a little while, especially when you have children who reach the age when they're hard to love. Have your kids ever gone through a stage when they've been hard to love? If not, I'd like to know about it, because obviously Australian kids must be different than the kids that we have at home. Sometimes you have these children, they come into your life, you're grateful for them, you love them, but if you could just give them away for 6 months at least until they get through the present stage. Sometimes I need to say, Lord, help me to be loving because I'm not innately inclined to do that. Lord, help me to show loving behavior because sometimes that doesn't come easy. And I think we as Christians need to recognize that the love that is of Christ has to flow through us to reach out and touch our family. Sometimes I think we get so busy with our careers, we get so busy with our ministries, we can get so busy with the things that we're involved in doing that we forget our families. Let me give you a personal example that is a little bit painful. Some of you have been carrying around a big book called Christian Counseling. And some of you have asked me to autograph the book called Christian Counseling. I wrote the first edition, and then I completely rewrote the book and did a second edition. Both times, the strain on our family was intense. The first time, Julie had lost her mother. And this was a difficult time for Julie, a depressing time for Julie. It was a difficult time for one of our kids who was having sort of a pre-puberal, probably, depression. And these things were going on in my own family, and I missed them because I was too busy writing a book on how to observe depression and how to deal with family problems. Interesting, isn't it? So the next edition I came back, I thought, well, I'm not going to let that happen. When I do the second edition, I'm going to be more sensitive to the needs of the family. But it didn't quite work that way. And I got so consumed in this because the second edition, my father, just after I got started in this, my father had a heart attack. And suddenly I discovered something in my own family that I had not encountered before. See, they were my parents in their 70s. And I was the son, and I had a sister, and then I had my children. And somebody asked me to write an article about the sandwich generation, where some of you are. Where you're taking care of your older parents and your teenage kids, and in the middle, and I didn't know much about it, but I did some research and wrote the article. And the day on which the article appeared in the magazine, I got the magazine, and I opened it, and I read my own article. And couldn't believe how my own article suddenly was no longer just an academic article. It was talking to me. Because my father was close to death. My mother was depending on me. I had suddenly taken the role then as sort of the leader of the family. And I had my parents to be concerned about, my sister to be concerned about in her family, my wife and my own family to be concerned about. My father was in Canada, about 500 miles from where we live. But sometimes I had to go 9 times in the next 8 months. I had to get on a plane and fly up there. I don't complain about it. But it was difficult. I just get going on the book again, and I get a call. Dad's not like it'll last the night. I get on a plane and go up there. And the doctor said, Gary, there's something about it. When you walk in, he rejuvenates. And I was grateful for that. But I began to recognize that my own father was depending a great deal on me, and much of his life during those last few weeks and that last few months were depending on me, and I wasn't really prepared for this. And sometimes they'd call me. One morning we got a telephone call, and my mother said, Gary, I know you're busy, but Dad wants to ask a question. And we thought, he said, I wish Gary was here to ask him. And they were sitting on the little veranda of the place where they lived. And Dad said, do you think it's okay to pray for the Lord to take me home? So they dropped everything and called me to ask if that was okay. Now, can you think what that was doing while I'm trying to write a book? Just like it influences you when you go through these crises, and just like it influences everybody else. And here I am trying to write a book about people helping and to take care of my father who is close to death and my mother who is going through all these readjustments and my wife who is carrying on really valiantly at home and handling our teenage kids. See, it wasn't easy. And somehow it was hard to maintain love in those difficult times. And we all encounter them, don't we? And people in our churches encounter them. And that's very often when you need other people to love you and to support you and to hold you up and to care for you. And even people helpers need that kind of caring. And if we are going to be people who are building good families, our families need to be characterized by love. That needs to be stimulated. We also have to recognize that our families need to be characterized by purity. The Bible gets pretty specific in verse 3. Among you there must not be even any hint of sexual immorality or any kind of impurity or of greed. Interesting, that's put in the middle of that list. Because these are improper for God's holy people. There should not be obscenity, foolish talk, or coarse joking, which are out of place, but rather thanksgiving. For of this you can be pure. No immoral, impure, or greedy person, such a man as an idolater, has any inheritance in the kingdom of Christ and of God. There's a high call for purity. Have you noticed the societies in which we live? There is not a high call for purity, I discovered, in the Australian society. And I can say that in no way implying that I'm criticizing this society, because there's no high call for purity in the society from which I come. And it seems that we are almost in a society that is getting worse. And what encourages me, however, is that when Paul wrote the epistles, and Peter wrote the epistles, and John and the other writers, they were living in societies that were more corrupt than ours are. But it is very difficult to keep our minds pure. Julie and I, on the way back to the hotel this afternoon, we just stopped into a little store on the way just to see what was there, picked up a couple of things. And as we did, I noticed that here, right in front of the counter where people pay the money, are all of these magazines with nude women on the cover. Out blatantly displayed, how then can we maintain a purity in our own lifestyles, encouraging our kids to maintain that kind of purity, and yet the Scriptures give us a high standard here? I am convinced, it's interesting, it talks about obscenity and foolish talk and coarse joking. Sometimes I think the devil is very subtle in the way he drags us down, even believers. And sometimes we think thoughts that are not pure. And then eventually we're more inclined to talk about things that aren't pure. And it's almost like our minds are being plowed up so when the opportunity comes along, we fall into behavior that isn't pure. And this is true of people in our churches, and it's true of ourselves if we're honest. And we have a call here for purity. Good families are not going to be built when there is impurity. Sometimes I think we know this is important, but we don't talk about it in the church. I talked to two people today who are involved in counseling AIDS victims and some of the difficulties of counseling AIDS victims and some of the impure behavior and yet still the struggles of the church rejecting AIDS victims. People who are experiencing a great deal of need for compassion. I think Jesus would have been concerned about the AIDS victims in our society, even though he would not have approved of much of their behavior, of some of their behavior that perhaps, with some of them at least, led to their getting AIDS. But there needs to be a purity and a call for that. That's crucial to the family. But then it says we should live in the light. Now that gets a little bit theological, doesn't it? Look down at verse 8. For you were once in darkness, but now you are light in the Lord. Live as children of the light. Now what in the world does that mean? How am I going to live in the light? You'll remember in the Bible that darkness refers to that which is wicked. Light refers to that which is good. And in case you don't know what light is, in case we forget, the Scriptures tell us. Light refers to such things as goodness and righteousness and truth. Those are the things that characterize the light. Now how am I going to live in the light? How do I live in the light? What does that mean? Well, it tells me, find out what pleases the Lord. Here's a place for obedience. When I get back, the first Sunday, we'll be back home over Easter Sunday morning. And I'll be meeting with this young group of married couples that we meet with every Sunday morning. I thought I'd better prepare my comments for that Sunday morning before I went on the trip, because I might be too tired to prepare it after I get back. So we're going to focus on the last chapter of Matthew, which won't surprise you, is that it's the Easter morning story. But what was interesting to me, I've been reading this over again and again on this trip, and a lot of different things have come out. And those women went to the tomb, this is fascinating to me, looking for Jesus. And the angel said, go and tell the disciples. So they went immediately, And in the midst of their obedience, they met Jesus. They didn't quite sit around until they met him, and then they'd be obedient. They obeyed, and off they went, and in the midst of that, they met Jesus. Find out what pleases the Lord, and start doing this. Then I think we begin to grow spiritually, and we see God begin to work in our lives and in our homes. That's how we live in the light. But there's more to that. Have nothing to do with the fruitless deeds of darkness, but rather expose them. For it is shameful even to mention what the disobedient do in secret. Everything ultimately is going to be exposed. I discover sometimes, and I would guess that I'm not the only one, that sometimes I'm moving along, I've had a good time maybe in my devotional life, and all of a sudden something pops into my mind, and I think, how did that get there? Where did that come from? Maybe it's something I see just as I'm passing a newsstand, something that hits my mind, and I recognize that the devil's first line of attack, it seems, is in the mind. And I've got to live in the light. It's a challenge. And that becomes important for all of us in building our family relationships and ministering to other people in the families. We ought to live in the light, find out what's pleasing to the Lord, and doing it, and having nothing to do with the deeds of darkness. Then we need to be people who are wise. So we see this in verse 15. Be careful then how you live, not as unwise, but as wise. Now, I would like to be wise, wouldn't you? But somebody is, sometimes I think, well, you get to be wise when you're about 80. How can you be wise when you're younger? Well, becoming wise is probably a lifelong process, and we're moving in that direction. And how are people like us going to be wise? Well, just in case there's any question, it tells us in verse 16, making the most of every opportunity, because the days are evil. We are living in a time of evil. That's true. And we make the most of every opportunity, serving the Lord as effectively as we can and doing what we feel God leads us to do to strengthen families, beginning with our own and with the families around us. And then it tells us that we should be people who are, and here, notice verse 17, do not be foolish, but understand what the Lord's will is. And I'm convinced that we've all got messages and have heard messages on finding God's will. I suspect that the first step is to want God to lead, and ultimately I think He will, in His own ways, sometimes in dramatic ways, sometimes through the use of our God-given brains. I was born in the same year as Elvis Presley. I was born in the same year as Pat Boone. But I know through my God-given brain that God did not call me to be a musician. Because I can't sing. At least, not well enough to perform. Of course, I don't know that you need to be well enough to perform. If you have a loud enough band, it doesn't really matter anymore. But I'm using my mind to see where God wants me to be and what He wants me to do. And I think this is true of all of us. And some of you, I suggest, will have an influence on families. And some of you will not. Your ministry will be someplace else. Some of you, I suspect, have a marvelous way of working with teenagers. Some of you don't quite know how to relate to teenagers. And we probably look around us and see specific groups. As I mentioned, Julie and I seem to have fallen into a ministry with young adults. And that's been true of our whole married life. And we've had these people, the 20-year-olds in the early 30s, in our house, and they surrounded us since we've been married. Even when we were about that age. Okay, we seem to work well with those people. But maybe there's other groups of people that we don't work well with. Ask the Lord to show you where you can have your impact. Some of you may have a tremendous impact with single parents. Or you may have an impact with older people. Or maybe parents that come from broken homes, or people that come from broken homes, or people who are struggling with divorce, or the effects of divorce in their lives. And God puts us in different places. And that's exciting to me. Well, just a couple more. If we're going to build good families, we need to be people who are spiritual. So you don't get drunk on wine, which leads to debauchery. We can make some interesting comments here if we wanted to about the effect of alcoholism on the home. But be filled with the Spirit. Remember my definition of counseling this morning? If we are spirit-filled people, our lives are going to be different. We're going to be people who have a joyfulness. That doesn't mean we're always bubbling over with happiness, but down deep, we are able to speak to one another with psalms and hymns and spiritual songs and sing and make music in your heart to the Lord, always giving thanks to the Father for everything in the name of our Lord Jesus Christ. And it's interesting to me to think about this, that when the Holy Spirit guides us, even when we run into family problems in our own homes, we can sense that security, that God is still there, and He's still leading, and that ultimately things are going to be okay. Sometimes I have to remind myself, this too will pass. Think about that, especially if you've got kids at the stage where you think, I'm at my wit's end. Now, one other suggestion. You remember it starts at verse 21. Sometimes people who preach on this passage start with verse 22. Wives, submit to your husbands. But don't miss verse 21. Submit to one another out of reverence for Christ. So I would suggest to you that there's a place for a mutual submission within a marriage. Well, then we go on with the roles of the husband and the wife and the children, as we mentioned. And we get to chapter 6. And we're reading about the fact around verse 10 or 11 that we are not wrestling, verse 12, against flesh and blood, but against principalities and powers. Have you ever thought of the fact that Christian counseling may be that kind of a wrestling? That if you are involved in Christian counseling, you are involved in a battle. Because you are trying, as a Christian counselor, to undo what the devil has been trying to do over the past years or months or maybe a whole lifetime. And you are trying to undo the effects of alcoholism, the effects of broken homes, the effects of anxiety, the effects of persisting depression. You're trying to undo that. And you can only do it with the help of the Lord. That's why this emphasis on the Holy Spirit is so important. And while we talk about putting on the whole armor of God, and it talks at the end of this passage about the importance of the Word of God, talks about the importance of prayer, it talks about the importance of being alert, and the apostle who writes this, this spiritual man of God, has no hesitation praying, saying in verse 19, pray also for me, that whenever I open my mouth, words may be given to me so that I may fearlessly make known the mystery of the gospel for which I am an ambassador in chains. Julie and I have a little support group behind us. There's two groups of people who pray for me, especially when I go on these trips and for us together. And I don't think there has been a day, I know a day hasn't passed on this trip, and I haven't thought several times, and often have said to Julie, you know, those people are praying for us. And probably at home right now, it's very early in the morning, most of them are not up yet. But I bet a lot of them will get up and they'll pray for us. And they'll pray for you. And they'll be praying for those of us who are meeting together here in Brisbane. And a lot of them have got a schedule and they're kind of following the schedule. And they'll say, well, Gary and Julie must be in Brisbane now. They're having a conference there. And they are praying. And I don't hesitate to ask for their prayers. And I think when we learn to pray for one another, and pray for one another who have family struggles, because sometimes in the church we hide our family struggles. We have, Julie and I have some very good friends who've had some difficulties with their kids. Not long ago, this one man, he said, Gary, he said, he mentioned John White's book, Parents in Pain. He said, we need a Parents in Pain group in our church because there's a lot of parents in pain. And I think sometimes we forget about that. But let me suggest that here is a biblical guideline for some building of family relationships. Gene Getz, who has written about the family once, said the Bible doesn't say much about family relationships specifically. This passage in Ephesians 5 is the most complete passage on family relationships in the whole Bible. But Getz says, all of what the Bible teaches about relationships really applies to the family. And so when we start looking through the Scriptures, we can see the Scriptures have great relevance to our families and building families. Well, this is a biblical illustration to begin with. That was my first point tonight. Remember, a biblical perspective. Then let's talk about a research perspective. I hope I don't bore you if I remind you of some research that has been done now several years ago. But I think it is well to emphasize this research. I hesitated about bringing it in because I thought some of you may have encountered this. But it was work done by a psychologist named Rick Stinnett, S-T-I-N-N-E-T. Dr. Stinnett was very much concerned not about families that were disintegrating, but about healthy families. He said, we've got a lot of emphasis on marriages and families that are falling apart and why they're falling apart. Are there families that survive? And if so, what causes those families to survive? So he tried to find some healthy families. He started by locating 350 families. He started in the United States to do this and then extended it to other parts of the world. He said we want people who meet four criteria. Number one, all couples must consider themselves to be happily married. Number two, they must be satisfied with their parenting relationships within the family. Number three, for the sake of uniformity in the study, all the marriages are to be first marriages. And number four, all the families must still be intact. If a family says they're having a happy family because everybody's disintegrated and gone separate ways, that doesn't count. So you've all got to be intact and having a good relationship. Well, he was able to find 350 families like this. 60% came from urban areas. He went throughout the United States initially. He tried to find families that were from different parts of the country, from different socioeconomic levels, different age levels, and representing different groups of the population. So we had people who were blacks and whites, Polish people, Jews, Italian, Hispanics, people from other groups, and he said there was a clear consistency with the breakdown of the people in the country. Subsequently, Dr. Sine and his researchers repeated the study in Europe, in parts of Asia, but I don't think in Australia, but in enough other parts of the world that he was able to say that his conclusions seemed to be typical not just in one country, but spread throughout the world. And he discovered six characteristics of a healthy family. These families were not necessarily Christian families. They were finding happy families. Here's what he found. Happy families, number one, spent time together. They didn't always do a lot of exciting things together. They didn't always spend a lot of money together. Sometimes the families were such that the family was split, that maybe there was a single parent was leading the family with all the difficulties that are involved in that. But nevertheless, they spent time together. And this became an important criteria within the family hierarchy. And because they spent time together, it seemed they had some relationship to their families being happy. Number two, happy families showed appreciation for one another. Often in little ways. Often by giving compliments. Often by pointing out things that were positive. Have you ever thought about the fact that sometimes we don't even compliment people in our own families? We've tried to work on that in our family. Sometimes, and I'm delighted that Julie can be with me on this trip. It changes my whole perspective. We were having dinner tonight, and Julie was saying, I'm so glad she said that she could be here, because she said, Gary, there's no way that you could come home and describe Australia and really communicate that to me. Or describe the people. We had this experience today. I was here 2 years ago and met John and Joe Warlow. Went home and told Julie about them. Well, I told Julie about them. I showed Julie pictures of them, but there was no way for Julie to know what they're like until she met them today. And this way, she said to me, now I understand why you felt about these people the way you do. And it's wonderful when we can travel together and do things together, but that wasn't always possible, especially when our kids were younger. And Julie got into the habit of sending little notes with me, with a date on to open the notes. So I was sort of, this would be whatever day this is, the 21st of March, and she had a little note to open on the 21st of March, and she'd write all these cards, and my wife has trouble writing cards. It takes her a long time, and she'd work on all these cards, and they'd be in my luggage. Sometimes little notes in my socks. One time, she put a little note in my sock to tell me that she appreciated it. I did not notice the note, put on the sock, walked on it all day, and then took it off and tried to disintegrate it, you know, take it apart at night and see what the note said after having been saturated in sweaty feet. Boy, we get down to earth in this course, don't we? So she has subsequently stopped that. I sometimes will order maybe some flowers or something just to say I'm thinking about you, or 1 week from today I'll be home. Those are little tiny things. And I don't give the example from us. I give it to you because we're working on this. We're growing in this area. But families show appreciation. We try to remember to send our kids cards along the way, to just let them know that we're thinking about them, to let them know where we are. Our daughter in Scotland did not appreciate the call from Waikiki Beach, but nevertheless she knew that we were thinking about her, even while we called her. We said, we're thinking about you, but we're terribly sorry that the Lord has called us here to serve. We haven't heard from her since. But in any case, it's a case of showing appreciation. Happy families were characterized by this. Thirdly, happy families, Sinead discovered, dealt with crises in an effective way. Every family is going to face crises. And much of what we have to do as Christian counselors is to help families encounter crises. You know, I suspect, some of the ways to help families face crises. To admit honestly that they're involved in a crisis. To be honest about feelings. And to be encouraged to express their feelings of anxiety and hurt and pain and resentment and discouragement. When we're in a crisis, it hurts. And we're not fooling anybody except ourselves if we don't admit the pain and the feelings that God has given us to allow us to go through these crises. Then in a crisis, it's important to help people draw closer to those who can help. Friends can help. Relatives can help. Neighbors can help. Fellow church members can help. This gets back to what we've been talking about earlier today. Where the church can provide that supportive, caring relationship with people who are involved in struggles. Galatians chapter 6, verse 2, we are to bear one another's burdens and so fulfill the law of Christ. The law of Christ, remember Jesus said, a new commandment I give unto you, that you love one another. This was his new law, and we are showing that compassion and that burden bearing to other people, especially in times of stress. Incidentally, I have noticed in times of crises that it's much easier for me to give than to receive. Have you noticed that? If somebody else is struggling, I can be there and I can be giving help, but when I'm on the receiving end, there's something about me that says I can do it myself. He'll be right, mate. I threw that in. I've learned that, see? And I think that sometimes it's hard to stand back and accept that help. And I sometimes have said to people, if you're having trouble accepting help, remember, you are giving a gift to the caregiver who wants to help. Don't push away that caregiver who wants to help. Because many times that can help people through a crisis. We all know this. In a crisis, you need to understand the situation. What is going on? What is happening? What things are changeable? What things cannot be changed and have to be acceptable? Try to have an understanding of what is happening as best you can. Maybe in a crisis we need to learn some practical ways of coping with the problem. Have you ever noticed how that when you're in the midst of a crisis, you can't always see what to do? I remember when my father took his heart attack. Now, this was 3.5 years ago now. Julie got the telephone call. She came to the office to tell me about this. And my immediate reaction was, what am I going to do? I can't go up there now. How can I handle my classes? They've got to be dealt with. I've got other things to do. I can't leave now. And somebody said, Gary, you really need to let some other people make those decisions for you at this point. And I thought, that's right. Because in a time of crisis, you need to back off and let somebody else give you the help and the encouragement. And sometimes we need to do this sort of thing. We need to be involved in prayer for one another in times of crises, including crises in our own lives. We need to ponder what God is like and that God still cares about us, and that when you ask the question that Phil Yancey did in his book, where is God when it hurts? Sometimes it seems like God is far away, but he hasn't forgotten us. He's still there, even though we don't always sense that. And it's helpful in times of crises to meditate on the Scripture. It's helpful in times of crises to reach out to other people. Sometimes, after initially, we need to accept the help from others, but sometimes we sit around after a while and begin to feel sorry for ourselves, and sometimes there's nothing more effective than to get busy and to be reaching out to other people. Have you ever heard of the widow-to-widow program? Sometimes people who are widowed reach out to other widows. When my dad died, my mother said to me, I was talking to a neighbor, and I said, I don't know how I'm going to survive. I guess I'm not going to be able to survive without him. And the neighbor lady said, Vera, you'll survive. We know exactly where you are because there's about 6 of us in the same apartment complex, and we know how you're feeling because we felt the same way. But you'll get through this period, and you'll come out of it on the other side. We know it because it's happened to us, and we're going to be there to help you. And that's exactly what happened. And I think more than any counselor were those other widows in that condominium where my mother lived who helped her through this difficult time. And she came through it. And she has been very helpful in helping other people cope with the pain of widowhood. See, here's the idea of reach. And as she's reached out, she's begun to think. Several times she said, you know, I think I'm doing all right. I'm surprised at how far I've come. And when I start talking to somebody else who's been widowed more recently, she said, I begin to see that I've made some progress along the way. And that has been therapeutic for her. Well, okay, happy families deal with crises. How many have I given you? Three? Number four, happy families are committed to the family group. The family is a high order of priority. I wonder how many families in Australia place the family as a high order of priority. That survey is very interesting to me. But how you answer a survey and how you live your life might be very different. And it's interesting to wonder how many people have the family with such a high order of priority that they take the time away from career building to build their families. And that becomes of crucial importance, and perhaps that's enough to be said. Then happy families are able to communicate. We all know that that's a significant variable. But if you can't communicate, you can't very well get along. It's hard to communicate sometimes. Especially when your kids go through certain periods of time when they don't want to communicate. Especially when there's difficulties and tension and it's hard to communicate. Especially, if you're honest, when you would prefer not to communicate. Especially if you get a little depressed and you feel like withdrawing and not communicating. Sometimes if I'm busy with a project, like writing a book about people helping, I don't want to have to communicate about tensions in the family. And Julie knows that. But I try to work on it. I'm making progress. And I think by the time I'm 80, I may really have made some good progress in this. And it's wonderful to talk about the family and to have my wife here, because you can go back and check out any of this. And you can ask her. Some of you haven't discovered who she is yet, but you'll find out. Just listen. When she opens her mouth, you'll know immediately who she is, because she has an accent. And you can identify her. Well, it's good to have my wife here when I talk about the family, because who knows? I could be telling you things that I'm making up, and you wouldn't have the opportunity of interacting. And if my kids were here, you could check it out with them too. We have good rapport, but we don't have a perfect family. I don't think anybody does. But we have the characteristic of the sixth characteristic. Nick Stanay discovered that healthy families tend to be religious. Isn't that interesting? He found out that the family that prays together stays together. Now, it may be that healthy families go to church, and you start with a healthy family, and they just happen to be more inclined to be churchgoers. Or it may be the other way around, that people who go to church end up having better, more stable families. But it seems to be nationwide, worldwide, that happy families tended to be religious. And when they were involved in worship, then the family life was better. And that I think is a significant thing for us to think about. Well, here are some characteristics of healthy families, things that we can move towards. Now, with this biblical perspective in mind and this research perspective in mind, let me come to the third thing I want to talk about. Quite frankly, I wasn't planning to talk about this tonight. One of the things we need to do, I think, in a conference is to be alert to what's going on around us. And I began to recognize, as I interacted with people today, and as I reflected on my times with you, that here are a group of people who are sincere and deeply concerned about people helping. Concerned enough and serious enough to spend all day sitting here, from early this morning, participating in a conference like this. I know some of you have come in tonight after a busy day at work, and I appreciate this. Others of you have been here all day. And I imagine that some of you are getting tired. You will appreciate a kip. Is that right? But sometimes we recognize as counselors, including family counselors, and I'm moving into this part now of a counselor's perspective on family. Sometimes we forget that we aren't always wise as counselors. We aren't always right. We aren't always patient. We aren't always aware of what to do. We aren't always omnipotent and omniscient. We aren't always sinless. And we can't be always available, even though we may try to be. And when we look at ourselves, many of us, I suspect, maybe all of us at times, feel inadequate and ask ourselves, what am I doing in this kind of work? Why don't I get a real job? Working in a shopping center someplace, or working in an office or something like that, instead of trying to help people who are hurting. And if you notice that people who hurt, hurt at the most inconvenient hours. When you want to get away. Late at night. On the weekends. On holidays. And sometimes it's not easy to work with people who struggle. And too often, we want to be people helpers. We have the sincerity that I see reflected here in this group. There's no way that I'm going to be able to go home and explain to the people at home what the people are like in Australia and what the people are like at a conference in Brisbane. I'm going to try and tell them, but it's going to be hard because I sense a concern here and a commitment to counseling that I haven't encountered in a lot of the places that I've visited. But sometimes in our great desire to help people, including people who are struggling with family problems, we forget to say no. I've taught in the theological seminary for 20 years, and I said to students, you guys are really good at knowing all kinds of Hebrew words and all kinds of Greek words. Let me remind you of an English word that you ought to use more often, no. And it's wonderful for me to say that to these people. It's much more difficult for me to use it. Did you notice this today at lunch? When they decided that they would whisk me away and give me a half hour or 45 minutes just to kind of get rejuvenated and ready for the afternoon session. And I started talking to people. And poor old Sue kept tugging at my arm. And I kept talking to people because sometimes I'm my own worst enemy, aren't you? And I want to talk to people. I enjoy that. That's part of my life. And sometimes it's hard for me to say no. And it's hard for me to pull away even when I need to do it. Am I communicating? Do I have some kindred spirits here? I suspect most of us are the same way. And when that happens, we don't get sufficient rest. We don't admit our own needs. We sometimes forget our own families. And we wonder why we burn out. And so I'd like to conclude here by just briefly mentioning three terms that you've all heard before, but that apply to us as family counselors and apply to our own families. Burnout, fragmentation, and impairment. I'm not talking at you, brothers and sisters. I'm sharing what I think we all encounter. Number one is burnout. We've heard so much about this, even though the term didn't come into the literature until 1975. But we all know what it means. Here is a definition that came out of a professional journal. Burnout is a state of emotional exhaustion that comes because of the demands that come from working with people. Burnout has attracted professional and popular attention. The prime candidates for burnout are counselors, pastors, policemen, parents, teachers, almost anybody who works intensively with people. This topic has been discussed in professional meetings and popular seminars, and there have been a host of scholarly articles and popular books written about burnout. And probably you have seen some of them, and you have read some of these. Burnout has been described as an occupational hazard for counselors, including marriage and family. Counselors. Burnout can come to all of us, but it is especially inclined to come to people who have the following circumstances. Burnout is most likely to occur in people who are working alone, isolated, and away from colleague support. I would guess that describes some of you. You're cut off from colleagues. You may be working in an area where you don't have an opportunity to talk to anybody, and you wonder why you burn out. Burnout is common in people who limit their work to one kind of activity, such as seeing clients one after another with little variation in the routine. Sometimes we do this because there are so many people with so many needs who have so much that they need to get from us, and we want to help them. So one after another, we see people, and then we wonder why we burn out. Burnout is especially characteristic of people who give freely to others and don't take the time to care for their own needs. Burnout comes to people who work with especially difficult clients, like people who are critical, people who are unmotivated. This is some of you are teachers and you've got students like this. People who are demanding. People who are unpleasant to be with. Are any of your counselees like this? People who are deeply troubled. People who are involved in the occult. Or people who resist change. And sometimes we work with people and we think, I've worked with these people. I've done everything I know. They don't seem to want to change. I'm not getting any place. See, if you were selling vacuum cleaners, you would know at the end of the day whether you had a successful day. But you're not selling vacuum cleaners, most of you. You are working instead at trying to sell counseling techniques to people and trying to sell ideas to people. And you don't know whether you've got a cross or not. And you don't know whether you've been successful. And sometimes you work for years and don't see much progress. That's not easy work to do. No wonder you burn out. No wonder you get annoyed. And it comes out not with your counselees, but with your families. I remember one time, you will not understand this at all. You'll have to use your vivid imagination. But my plane was delayed in getting to a meeting because of an ice storm. You know what that means. But when I got there, I arrived and my luggage did not. So I went to the lady at the luggage desk to tell her that my luggage had not come, and there were all kinds of people lined up with the same problem. So, good old psychologist me, she comes up, wants to know what my luggage is like. I said, no, tell me, how are you handling all the complaints? I caught her off guard. And she looked at me with a funny look, because nobody had ever asked her that. Most people were complaining about the fact that their luggage was someplace else, and she didn't do it. She didn't create the ice storm. You know, it wasn't her fault. She was just a complaint taker. And she said, well, to be honest, sir, I smile here all day at the customers. But, oh, you ought to see me when I get home with my family. And doesn't that happen sometimes? And we work all day to be nice to the customers, and then we take it out on our families at home, and they suffer because of the pressure we face sometimes trying to help people build good marriages. People who have stresses and problems in their own homes are more inclined to burn out. People whose families and careers are having difficulties. People whose personal lives are not going well. All of this makes it difficult to deal with other people's problems and to deal with your own. And then how about this one? Burnout comes to people who give constantly to others but have little evidence that their clients are getting better. Recent study that I came across asked practitioners, counseling practitioners, what was the most stressful part of their work. 73.7% of the counselors said, the most stressful part of my work is a lack of apparent therapeutic success. And when you don't think you're being successful in building marriages, it gets to you. And it gets to your family. That's burnout. But wait till I get to the next one. If I didn't cover you with burnout, I'll get you on this one. I'd like to kind of slither over this because this gets awfully close to home. Not to my whole home, my part of my home. It's called fragmentation. It's the problem of being overextended. It is the problem of trying to do too much in too little time. Does that ever happen in laid-back, casual Australia? It's the problem of not realistically judging how long a project is going to take, how much time a project is going to take, and how much energy it's going to take. Julie has a gracious way of asking me periodically, are you sure you can do this? And my response is, oh, sure, it won't take very long. And the next thing you know, I've got all of these projects that won't take very long. And they take an awful lot longer than I think. As a result, we have too many things to do, too many diverse activities, too many commitments that are taking too much time and leaving us always feeling swamped and pressured, always running from one project to the next, too busy to relax, spreading yourself thinner and thinner, and wondering why your own family is suffering and why your own marriage is suffering and why you're not helping other people build their marriages. Do you relate to this? I do. Because it's probably the biggest struggle that I have. I get excited. I get excited about things. ask me to come back to Australia next week and I'll say, no, I've got to get ready for Japan. I've got other things I have to do. I've got books to write. Ask me to come back in 2 years and I'll whip out my calendar. I'll say, sure, there's nothing on the calendar. Then I start filling it all around. And the next thing you know, I look at what I've committed myself to. I've got to be awfully careful. I need some accountability. The problem is my wife tries to help me, and I don't always listen to my wife. Sometimes I listen to people outside the home who come back and say, hey, Gary, watch it, because you're going to get fragmented. And when I get fragmented, the quality of what I do goes down. My counseling work is not as good. My writing is not as good. My speaking is not as good because I'm fragmented. And then there's impairment. Burnout, fragmentation, and impairment. This refers to the personal distress, the inner turmoil, the feelings of inadequacy, and the decline in competency that comes to us because we're going too hard. It comes to therapists and leads some of our colleagues to marriage problems, to divorce, to difficulties with their kids, to drinking, to decline in their spiritual lives. I have a friend, haven't seen him for a few years, psychiatrist, committed Christian, led Bible studies in his church, taught in a theological school, but got too busy, and discovered that his own kids were having some problems. His own marriage was having problems, but he didn't have time to work on that. So he spent time working, getting more and more involved in his private practice, and one day he told me about this wonderful lady who was one of his clients who was really so understanding and really helped him to get a good perspective on the struggles he was having. You know what happened? This wonderful lady, he got closer and closer to the wonderful lady. His own marriage broke up. His own family went great ways of difficulty. He tried to convince himself and others that this was God's will for him, that he should spend time with his wonderful lady. He subsequently married her, and about 2 years later, that marriage broke up. Last I heard, he was on his third marriage. And here is a man who I think, in his own desire to be helpful, let his own family go down. Now, I'm not trying to point the finger at any of us. I'm saying, brothers and sisters, when we come to a conference like this on Christian counseling, let us at least spend a half an hour looking at ourselves. Somebody raised the question of the questions that came in tonight. Gary, you referred to a book, When Helping You Is Hurting Me. Who's the author? The lady's name is Renee Berry, B-E-R-R-Y. I think it's Carmen Renee Berry. The book, I think, is published by Harper & Row, and she's got a second book come out now, published in connection with a theologian. And she's pointing out the fact that sometimes we've got to back off and pace ourselves. And if you want a good example of this, then turn to Mark chapter 1 and look at Jesus. Because Jesus was surrounded by the crowds. He healed Peter's mother. They brought people late at night. He was going all the time. And yet Jesus never seemed to burn out, never got fragmented, and never got impaired in what he was doing. After the people left, he rested. Early in the morning, while it was yet day, he went out to a private place, a quiet place, and spent time with the Father. And the disciples came to him and said, Jesus, all those people you were dealing with last night, there's even more of them there now. Let's go back. The crowds are waiting. And Jesus made this strange statement. No, those people are needy, but no, I'm going to go someplace else. And Charles Hummel, in his little book, The Tyranny of the Urgent, says, maybe in that quiet time with the Father, Jesus recognized that he had priorities. He couldn't help everybody. But he asked God to lead him to where he should go and where he should have an impact. You can't help everybody, and neither can I. So we ask God to use us to touch the lives of those people who are around us. What about some practical things? You could come up with a list just as well as I could because you're counselors. But let me give you my list. Number one, recognize your limitations. No one person can do everything, and neither should we try. Sometimes we have to say no, but if you're like me, that is the hardest thing you've got to do. Especially when you know there's somebody who you could have an impact, and whose life you could have an impact. But sometimes you need to say no. Recognize your limitations. Secondly, take time to be with colleagues. With people who are not counselors. With people who can give you support. People who can give you diversion. People who can help you laugh. People with whom you can be accountable. People who help you relax. Even being at this conference, spending time talking about counseling can be therapeutic for you. because it gets you a chance to get away and to stop and to take stock and to meet other people and to find out about the Christian Counselors of Australia and the Queensland branch that's developing and how you can be in touch with other people. That's therapeutically helpful. Value this. Value the tea times and the coffee times and the opportunities to interact. That's great. Next, set some limits on demanding clients, especially those who want your help all the time. And learn to say no gently when unreasonable demands come from others. And it's hard when those demands come from employers or from professional colleagues and from church leaders. Have you ever noticed that some people will come along and they reinforce you for what you do? They say, oh, you do such a marvelous job. Nobody else can do it. You're the only one. And after a while, you kind of believe this. Or you may recognize, well, maybe there isn't another person who can do it as well as I can. And you do that, so you think, okay, I'll take on just one more thing, and everybody applauds you at the wonderful things you're doing, and you glow in all of these people who are genuinely your friends and genuinely wearing you out and don't even realize that they're doing it. And sometimes you have to back off, take some regular time outs for prayer, for Bible study, for meditation on the Scriptures, for reflections, for mini retreats, for sitting silently before God and asking God to communicate with you. Just getting to a place where it's alone and quiet. And take time for diversionary activities. And take time for exercise. Recognize how that can be helpful. We live in a cold climate. It's hard to get outside and walk in the wintertime. So I bought one of these marvelous little things. I can walk in the house now. And I turn this machine on, I can walk 2 miles without going further than the end of that microphone when I discipline myself to do it. And I discover that I can read a book while I walk like this. And there's a television set I can turn on. I can put in a videotape and I can learn about some new aspects of counseling while I'm walking. See, isn't it wonderful? But I have this marvelous little gimmick on this machine. And you put this little clip on your ear, and it goes into the machine and tells how fast your heart is beating, what your pulse is doing. It's interesting. When I read, when I watch some, even when I'm watching a lecture, my pulse goes up, my heartbeat goes up, and I'm learning to walk without that distraction. It's very difficult for me, because it's hard for me to sort of come down. Take time out for that. I heard that clock go 9 o'clock. Learn to see humor in a situation, even when people set alarm clocks to tell you to stop. And never forget Colossians 3:24. You are working for the Lord, brothers and sisters. And this may be a cliche, but it is nevertheless true. I have it typed and taped to my computer right in front of me. The only problem is I forget to look at it. But it's right there. These words, I have all the time I need to do all that God intends me to do. That's hard because sometimes I think God has given me enough to do. This is going to take a 36-hour day. Now, one last point before I stop. Archibald Hart is a psychologist who's a friend of mine who has written a book called Adrenaline and Stress. Some of you perhaps have seen it. Now, there are probably several hundred books on stress. I even wrote one myself several years ago. And we all have heard a lot about stress. But Dr. Hart takes a different approach. He ties it in to the pumping of adrenaline through our bodies. And he says that stress doesn't just come when we have a crisis. It just doesn't come when we have an accident. It just doesn't come in difficult times. Stress comes and adrenaline pumps when there's exciting things going on. This is an exciting conference. I can get really fired up about this. I went back to the hotel room last night. Was I ready to sleep? No way! Because we had a good time last night. And he says that sometimes it takes a while for you to come down off that adrenaline high. And he argues that many of us, maybe most of us in this room, live in a perpetual adrenaline high. And he said when you're on an adrenaline high, you don't need much sleep. You get by in 4 or 5 hours a night. And you keep going all the time, and you just thrive on this. And he was talking about this last week in Melbourne, and I said to Julie, he's describing me. Well, she knew that. You know, she's a perceptive lady. And I said, Arch, I've got your book at home, but I've never read it. Did I tell you I got a copy of the book on the trip? When I got to Adelaide, the word people had wrapped up a copy of the book and had it waiting in the hotel room when I'd been there. Mind you, I haven't got it read yet because I've been so busy running on my adrenaline highs in the last 2 weeks that I haven't had time to read the book, but I'm partway through it and I'm learning to slow down. I hope. But let me suggest that if we're going to talk about marriage and the family, we need to look at what the Scripture says about it. We need to be aware of what research says about it. And we need to be aware of its effect in our own lives and in our own families. Well, the clock that went off 3 minutes ago reminds me that I have talked too long. I thought the chairman of our session had left to go home to be with his wife and family. But guess what? He is still here. He is coming forward in my meeting. People don't usually come forward in my meetings. He is coming forward. While he is doing so, why don't you stand up, take a stretch, and then we'll come back and hit the questions. And
questions you'd like to ask?
Sure.
Thank you, Wesley.
Dr. Collins, the 20th century has had many names, the age of anxiety and so on and so on. One of the things that strikes me is the age of alienation, and it seems to me that even in the church, many of us in the church are in isolated nuclear units or in split families or isolated individuals. And we're hearing about the family, and it makes me wonder about Scripture, because Scripture or Revelation was given within the context of the extended family.
That's true.
And it seems there's almost a need for a rewrite of the of theology to meet the splintered society of today.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just wondering, what do you see as the needs of the church in an age of hurting people who, even with, say, home fellowship groups and all of the things that the church is structuring to meet those needs, that still there are many people across a whole spate of churches that have used these techniques for some time are not seeming to resolve the deep alienation that people suffer. I hope I haven't overstated my case, but I do believe there's some truth in it.
Yeah. Oh, I think you're right. I think there is a lot of alienation, but I think we have to recognize that the family, I'm glad you said, I thought you were going to say we need to rewrite the Bible. I'm glad you said we need to rewrite the theology. I think we need to recognize that a lot of what we've written about the family, we assume that it's kind of, you know, the mother who's the homemaker, the father who goes off to work, and the 2.4 children or whatever the percentage is, and the family dog. And we recognize that most families are not like that. Now, I know you, I think you take a census, what, every 5 years in Australia? We take a census every 10 years. And it's very interesting to look at the census data. And the last census that was taken just in 1990, I understand that you're about to do one now, we're doing one about this time. At home, that traditional family comprises, I think, 10 or 11% of the living units in the country. Only 10 or 11. Because if you start looking at families at home, you discover that they're very diverse. You have single parent families, there are a lot of those. You have families where one of the parents is absent. You have families where a husband and wife are both involved in parenting even though they no longer live together and may no longer be married to one another. We came across from Perth to I guess we're going to Adelaide the other day, the little girl on the plane. She was just a little tiny thing. And I asked her where she'd been. She said, I've been to see my daddy. And she said, I'm going back home to my mom. And here's a little girl with parents in different parts of the country traveling back and forth. That's a different kind of family unit. Then you have blended families where two people come together and marry, and they each bring their kids with them. And the blend doesn't always work out as well as you might think. Or you have families that are composed of, well, basically a couple that's living together after their children are gone. That's a different kind of family. You may have families of several adults. So it's interesting article appeared at home on one of our news magazines about 6 months ago. And it has a woman, probably about in her 40s, with her mother, who is obviously an older lady. And it says the average American woman will spend 17 years caring for her children and 18.5 years caring for her elderly parents. Isn't that interesting? So you may have families then that have older relatives living with you. Now, basically what we're saying is the family is a diverse unit in our society, and it's constantly changing, and we must recognize that. And if we don't take into consideration these different types of families, then I think we're really missing a marvelous opportunity for ministry. And I think we've got to be aware of that as we reach out to people around. Somebody just asked me, what about the ministry to singles? What about two single people that live together, or four single people that live together? They live together as a family. And they may not plan to live together permanently in that kind of a relationship, but basically they're living together. It's less expensive. They've got companionship, and they live together. They live together in that kind of a relationship. How many people live with members of the opposite sex, and they're not married? And we might not think of that as a family, but the Census Bureau considers that a family unit. What about two people of the same sex that live together and in a homosexual relationship? Now, we struggle with that because of what the Scriptures teach about homosexuality, but the Census Bureau considers that a family unit. And I think we need to be aware of this diversity, aware of this really fractionization of the family, if there's such a word. After a comment about the extended family and the Scriptures talking about that, I think that's right. When I was in Bombay several years ago, and I had an interesting lunch one day with a man who said, "I hope that our family counseling doesn't become like your family counseling." Because he said, "You talk about a husband and wife and their kids, and that's what you think of as a family. Or you work with individuals one-on-one. But here, we have the extended family where the aunts and the uncles and the cousins and the grandparents are all involved. And you don't counsel with one member, you deal with the entire family." You see some of that in some of the Oriental cultures. And we need to be aware of that. It changes our whole perspective on family counseling. Lord willing, tomorrow, I want to talk about some of the ways that we can radically change our ways of looking at counseling. One of those ways is we may find that we're going to be doing less and less one-on-one counseling. And we're going to have to be dealing with broader groups of people, maybe a whole family unit. And that's going to be very difficult. Maybe a family unit that is from another country. I read an article not long ago called "The Asianization of Australia." You know what that's about? How do you relate to the Asian families in your midst and the challenges that they bring and the different perspectives that they bring? All of these are crucial issues, and I think we've got to keep that in mind as we deal with the family and recognize that the family is broader than just what we've considered on a traditional basis. And I think you're right. If the church doesn't deal with that, we're going to miss the families, because most families in our society are not the traditional kinds of families that we think about. I hope there was more comment I think you made, and hope I answered what you were thinking about. Because
just
I think it's
just add one thing. Leave that up, Peter, if we didn't. Thanks. Just one thing about the wizard was saying. What should churches be doing in that sort of area? I mean, we recognise, say, the problem.
Yeah.
But the challenge is then to move beyond the problem recognition to doing something about it.
It's easier to recognise the problem.
Sure. Okay. Well, that's the end of that. Next question.
Okay. Let's take the next question. Yes, you do
a
fine
great
job.
Courage, yes.
Yeah, and we want to have you. I want to compliment you on your creativity. Okay. I suppose we've got to be sensitive to the needs of people. Maybe that's a good place to start. And here again, I think if the church is meeting needs, people are going to come. It's interesting to me that if you talk about you talk about parenting, people will come to something on parenting. And maybe you need to think more about seminars. Look at the seminar that Jill and Stuart Briscoe are going to do, for example. They're doing a seminar on families. Now a seminar can be very threatening, and some people don't want to come. So then you go back to the kinds of things I mentioned this morning, where you maybe have a meeting for men, where you bring some kind of a sports figure in. You need to think of how we can meet the needs of different members of the family, and it may be we need to have a different kind of music, we may need to have different kind of format in our church services, we maybe even need to have different times in our church services. I'm told that many of the church services were held at 11 o'clock in the early days because the farmers would go out, do their work in the morning, and come home at 11 o'clock. One of the churches in our area has services on 9 o'clock Sunday morning, 11 o'clock Sunday morning, and 6 o'clock Saturday night. You know why they have them on Saturday night? Because they reach a lot of yuppies who are not accustomed to going to church and don't like the idea of getting up and going to church in the morning. So we'll have a meeting Saturday night, and a lot of those are people who never thought of going to church. They're used to going up to the bars on Saturday night. So we have church before they go to the bars, and ultimately, they go to church and they don't go to the bars. But it's a time when you hold the service. Maybe we've got to think about that. Maybe even where we have the services. So I think that kind of creativity, go around the circle I had on the board today. Maybe think about some preventive things. Think about some things that you can say when you speak to people in that public way. Think about some of the needs people have and creative ways to deal with them. I think here's a place where we've got to take counseling and move it beyond one-on-one sitting in an office. I'm going to push on that tomorrow if I can a little bit. Not push, I don't want to give the wrong impression. But when we talk about the trends that are taking place and where I think we're going, that I think is one of the trends. And we've got to think of more innovative ways to break out of the little counseling box, the way we've looked at counseling, and thinking people helping in its broadest perspective. It's a big question. I'm sorry I don't have a better answer. You know, this lady down there had her hand up. I thought, were you just stretching? Just stretching. Well, good. I'm waving. Nice to see you. Thank you. Anybody else want to wave? Okay, seriously, yes, sir, we've got a question. Can you just get to that nearby microphone? Thank you.
My question was going to be on your last comment, actually, about restructuring approaches to counseling, yes. Moving beyond one person after another and so mm-hmm. on. Mm-hmm. There's a scripture that comes to me about the whole approach of teaching is in Deuteronomy 6, I think it is, where it says that you will teach your children when you walk by the way, when you lie down, when you rise up. It's a much more natural way of teaching than in a more formal setting.
Right.
And we are very formalised in this kind of setting we're familiar with classes or clients and that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So I would really like to hear a little bit more, because I may not be here tomorrow and others may not be, to hear what are the trends in restructuring.
Right.
I've already made my own decisions about that and have a much more longer approach and a more holistic approach to bringing people under influence of teaching and counselling, which is not necessarily in a clinical sense.
Yeah.
So your comments on that, on what are the innovations?
Yeah. I'd like to say I don't want to jump too far ahead tomorrow, but just make a couple of comments if I can at this point. I think that I don't want in any way to put down the clinical approach. I don't want to in any way criticize that one-on-one approach in offices, because I think that needs to be done and it will always need to be done. And if you are involved in that, that's a significant part of your helping ministry. However, I think we probably need to move more into what a couple of people have raised, more of an educational model. And I think we're seeing that in the field. And by an educational model, that just doesn't mean teaching. You teach people in a variety of ways. You can teach them in this way, but this is a relatively inefficient way. You're much better to teach people by giving them experiences, by giving them modeling, by being examples to people, by letting them see what a family is like. Somebody has suggested in a book that I read recently that what we have to do as a church is prove to the society around us that marriages can live, can survive and grow for 10, 20, 30, 40 years. We have to model that. We have to demonstrate that. With our own kids, if you sit your kids down to tell them something, you don't get very far, do you? But if you kind of are aware of your children, let them model things. Our own kids are now at the age where they said to us, Mom and Dad, we've seen you. We've seen you do some things. We've watched how you communicate. We've learned just by the way you've lived your lives. And that's pretty sobering to think about. And people see us as we go about our business, as we go about our activities, and as we're sensitive to people who are around, and ask the Lord to give us that psychological moment, the right teaching moment. And often we can have a great deal of influence. I think a lot of counseling comes on the way to basketball games, sitting in coffee shops, interacting with people as you drive off someplace together. And sometimes that's where the best counseling comes, sitting around the fireplace at night, times when you least expect it, and up comes something. You're riding in a car someplace, and you get talking about something.
Sound Words Tape Ministry, Queensland. We're at the Kenmore Baptist Church for the special conference with Dr. Gary Collins from the US of A. This is now session 4 and cassette number 4 in the series, and this topic for this evening, Thursday evening, is the Caring Christian's Approach to Family Breakdown, session 4, Thursday the 21st of March 1991.
Well, it's my privilege to introduce Dr. Gary Collins to us, and what a joy it is to have him here. I trust that you've enjoyed his humour. He's worked hard at that. He's still working at it, actually. Every word you say, he's picking up and writing stuff down just so that he can relate. I think that's fantastic. And I think it's a great credit to him as a person in wanting to identify and associate with us on our own cultural basis. I was asking him just before the session tonight as to what sort of involvement he had with family ministry, as apart from his extensive involvement in many other areas. And he informed me that a few years ago he was program director for a congress on family. There are over 2,000 people in attendance at that congress. And apparently it was at St. Louis, and there were many issues covered about family. And I believe that his prior work and that involvement in that conference and work since then has probably given him a tremendous insight and enthusiasm for working in this area of family. I'd like you to give him a warm welcome tonight as he comes to speak to us, Dr. Gary Collins.
I'm sure you recognize that the people who are chairing each session and introducing me each time are members of the committee who have worked so hard to organize this this time together. I've been very impressed with their input and their warmth, and they've done a marvelous job. And I think that sometimes we forget just how much work has been done behind the scenes. This has been going on for probably at least 2 years since we started the initial communication about this this conference. And sometimes I tried very hard to prepare so that I could be ready, but I have learned some things since I've been here. For example, I learned today that I had a kip this afternoon. Do you know what a kip is? I never knew what a kip was. Somebody said, did you have a kip this afternoon? I said, no, we've already got two kids. No, it's not a kid, it's a kip. It's wonderful what I'm learning as I go back. It was a very short one, only 20 minutes, and I hope that some of you won't feel led to have a kip this evening, even though you've been here since early this morning and are hanging in there, and I really appreciate that. The fact that we're talking about marriage tonight and the family encouraged me to talk about an issue that Julie and I have that we're concerned about. You are all marriage counselors or involved in marriage, and this could be a serious issue. And I thought maybe I could bring it up before you, and we could you could talk to us and maybe help us in some way before we leave Queensland. We have run into the problem of the air in Queensland, in Australia in general, but I guess especially here in Queensland. There's something wrong with the air. It seems to be shrinking our clothes. That must be what it is, because they're getting tighter and tighter. I don't know whether the Pavlova has anything to do with it or these other things that we're experiencing, but I can tell you, next week we start on a diet, the day after Easter. But we have appreciated everything, really, that we've experienced since we've been here. The day before we left, I got a little notice in the mail from an old friend of mine, and he said, well, I've formed a new organization, Gary. I thought I'd tell you about it. It's an organization called the National Center for Fathering, of all things. And he said, I was very much concerned about building the family and how we as Christians could build the family. Where is there a place for building the family? Where is the major emphasis on building the family? And he said, we decided that we could strengthen fathers and the relationships that fathers have with their children. So the goals of the National Center on Fathering, I thought, were very interesting. Number one, to be a clear voice championing the role of fathering. Number two, to equip professionals, laymen, and groups working with fathers to more successfully help these men to actively lead in their homes and in their children's lives. Number three, to be a leading study center, library, and credible source of fathering data. And number four, to research the unique challenges faced by fathers who are culturally different, black, in the military, in prison, executives, clergy, and those who have the special role of stepfather, grandfather, or non-custodial father. I talked very briefly to these people. This man who formed this organization is a very good friend of mine. And I was impressed with what he was doing, focusing on the importance of the father because of the role that the father plays in the family and the role that the father plays in the home, and how the father has so often seems to have abdicated that role.